This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week, with the help of the Hubble Space Telescope, we got a glimpse of what happens when a comet collides with a planet. This seems like a good time to talk about Galileo, the 17th century astronomer who was the first to point a telescope at the heavens. His observations changed the course of science. Galileo is the subject of a new biography by James Reston Jr. He also wrote the Time magazine cover story in May about the comet Shoemaker-Levy. He told me his biography of Galileo got him excited about the comet crash on Jupiter. Galileo discovered the moons of Jupiter, and they are named after him, the Galilean satellites.
The moment that Galileo first sees the moons of Jupiter is one of the great moments in the life of Galileo and in the life of science. And so when I finished that historical work, I was very eager to sort of scratch and crawl my way back into the modern world. And here was this event I knew that was going to happen at Jupiter. But it was rather buried in the scientific press. There were little notices here and there, but on the face of it, it was such a knock your socks off kind of a thing that we would actually get to see this collision. So I really wanted to throw myself into it, and luckily Time was very eager to do something special. In point of fact, they took an enormous risk to make it into a major cover story, committing themselves well before they knew whether this thing was really going to be visible.
In your biography of Galileo, you said that what you're looking for is the precise moment when modern history was born. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a very clean thing about the discovery of the telescope. The world view of the entire globe in the 15th and 16th and into the 17th century really revolved around the notion that the Earth was at the center of the universe and man was at the center of God's construction of things, and that the heavens were put up in the sky rather like jewels or diamonds that were there fixed and perfect and uncorrupted, and that these were there really for the pleasure of man put there by God. So that when Galileo comes along and he doesn't actually discover the telescope, but he perfects a spyglass and then brilliantly turns it to the heavens for the first time, he can give you, in this case, scientific evidence that, in fact, the heavens do move. And here again, this brings us back up into the modern age, and last week with Shoemaker-Levy, it is the movement of the moons around the planet of Jupiter that really undercut the Middle Ages view of the world as being in the center of the universe. Here were moons that were actually in motion around another heavenly body, not fixed.
Now, he also observed with his telescope that there were sunspots, and that was considered blasphemous, too. Why?
Well, I love thinking about that last week in connection with Shoemaker-Levy, because the sunspots that Galileo sees on the sun are not that dissimilar from the black splotches that suddenly appeared on Jupiter last week. And again, this stitches back not only to the worldview, but the worldview as it was codified by the Roman Catholic Church, that the heavens were to be perfect; they could not be uncorrupt; they could not be corrupted or corruptible. And for a body, the source of our light and heat, to have blemishes on it would mean that it was corrupted in some way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Reston Jr., and his new book is a biography of Galileo. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Reston Jr., we're talking about his new biography of Galileo. Let's talk a little bit about the connection of the church and science at the time. They were the same thing. I mean, there wasn't scientists over here and the church over there.
Well, Terry, you have to understand, I really come out of a kind of novelist sensibility, and The wonder of the Galileo story was that you had this almost perfect rising action in this one life that comes to the climax in the attack of the Roman Catholic Church on Galileo. But what makes him so much more interesting as an individual is the fact that he was so devout himself. Mm-hmm. If he had been contemptuous of the Church and contemptuous of their attack on his science, it would have been a much, much less important case.
When Galileo is making these empirical observations with his telescope that contradict the Church's teachings, it backs up what Copernicus had said. Now, what was the Church's view of Copernicus, and how far had Copernicus gotten?
Well, Copernicus was actually a canon of the Church. He was and had been an advisor to popes, and so that, too, is, I think, a little understood fact. But what Copernicus does is to in effect, spin a new theory about the Earth revolving around the sun and the planets revolving around the sun. But he puts this out as theory only, and the theory and the book which contains it is published at the very end of Copernicus's life. It clearly raises eyebrows at the Vatican. Its implications are clearly difficult and awkward for the Vatican. But the fact that Copernicus is really on his deathbed as this work is published, it means that it just kind of languishes there in the scientific press. But what's different about Galileo from Copernicus is that he brings the evidence of his eyes that comes through the telescope, and he can put the telescope before powerful churchmen, and they can see with their own eyes also these moving moons of Jupiter, for example. And then it becomes for the Church to grapple with the new science. How would the Church do that?
And the Church is trying to figure out how it deals with empirical information that contradicts some very fundamental Church teachings of the time.
Precisely. And in Copernicus's case, they could just say, well, you're wrong, and we'll just let your book languish, and that would be that.
How was Galileo punished for his theory?
What happens to Galileo is that he is humiliated in an excruciating moment in human history where he is forced to recant his beliefs in the Copernican system. And after this horrible humiliation, he is then sent into exile above Florence. Not many of us would think of that as a terrible fate, I suppose, but he is really under house arrest for the last 8 years of his life in Arcetri, which is right above Florence.
So Galileo dies under virtual house arrest. He dies while he's banned from teaching or even believing his point of view. He's supposed to not believe it anymore. But the Church doesn't admit its error until 1992. What reopened the case for the Roman Catholic Church? What reopened the Galileo case?
Well, that is what I had hoped would make this book have an aura of being fresh and needed now. The fact that in 1979 this pope decided to reopen the Galileo case, to, as he said, earnestly study it. And then, mysteriously, it took them 13 years to come to a conclusion on it. And my guess is that once they opened up the question, they saw that there was really no way for the Church to come out very well in all of this. And I think as important as that is that they were concerned that if they announced a kind of error of judgment in Galileo's case, that it would undermine the authority of the Church today in modern times on such questions as abortion and biotechnology and other scientific issues that intersect with morals and with theology. And I think that's why it took them so long. But finally, they do make an announcement. What I'm told about that October 1992 mea culpa of the Pope's is that he simply said, "We opened it up, and we have to come to a conclusion. And if your facts are in order, you're saying this to a cardinal, then we have to come forward." So I think we have to give this Pope some real credit.
What explanations does the Church give now for condemning Galileo and for taking this long to...
Well, that gets into the more subtle side of it, about what their argument is, whether this is really a sincere and total expression of apology. When you talk to churchmen about the Galileo case, what they're inclined to do is to talk a lot about the disobedience of Galileo. And in order to understand that argument, you have to know the facts a bit. There were really two proceedings against Galileo that were 16 years apart. And in some ways, the more important one was not the one at the end where he's humiliated in front of the cardinals, but the one in 1616 where he is called in by the chief intellectual of the Church and told that he is not to teach or hold the Copernican theory. And what Galileo does after that warning by the Church is that he goes out and writes this great dialogue called the Dialogue of Concerning the Chief World Systems. And this is interpreted as indeed being an argument for the Copernican theory. And so what churchmen today will say is that the second trial of Galileo had nothing at all to do with the Copernican theory. It had everything to do with whether or not Galileo had been disobedient to the command of the Church.
If the Galileo story begins the real split between the Church and science, what do you think the legacy of that split has been for both science and the Church?
Well, what the Galileo case did to the Roman Catholic Church was to put the label on it as being anti-science and anti-intellectual. And this has been a bone in the throat of the Church for 350 years. And they have gone to extraordinary lengths, decade in and decade out, and century in and century out, to prove that they were not like the churchmen who sent Galileo away, but that they were very open to science, and that they were promoters of science and knowledge. One of the very interesting things to me is that the Catholic Church brought into existence a set of observatories, and they trained Jesuits to be very fine astronomers. And this began in the late 19th century. There is now a Vatican observatory out on the mountaintop in Arizona, for example, where they do very, very good science. Well, there's no doubt in my mind that all of this emphasis of the Roman Catholic Church in the last 150 years to show that they were welcoming of science and scientific knowledge is really built upon guilt over the Galileo case.
What about the legacy for science?
Well, the legacy for science we saw somewhat last week with Shoemaker-Levy, and I think this is the other side of it, and the regrettable side, that scientists stay as far away from spirituality and from poetry as they possibly can. They feel that science is at least last week it certainly was clear to me that science was about measurement. How big were these comets going into Jupiter, and how big was the energy, and how many megatons, and so on? That science is about measurement. But when something so unique, it was said to be an event that comes once every 1,000 years, and it stitches back to the possibility that the Earth was also hit by comets, and that's how we got our oceans, and that's how we got the constituents of life on Earth. So to actually witness something that may also have happened here and made it possible for for living organisms to come into being. That's really a moment of for great reflection. And it's not only about the brain, but it's about the soul and the spirit. And the scientists are uncomfortable on that turf.
James Reston, Jr., he's the author of a new biography of Galileo. This is Fresh Air.